The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am thrilled to introduce our guest this evening. Making his bones in Philadelphia as the Artistic Director of the Theater of the Living Arts, Andre Gregory went on to found the Manhattan Project Theater Group and direct the first production of a Wallace Shawn play. His and Shawn's close association and friendship led to their collaboration with Louis Malle and the production of the 1981 cult classic My Dinner with Andre. Gregory's other work includes roles in Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ, Brian De Palma's Bonfire of the Vanities, and most recently, Jonathan Demme's screen interpretation of Ibsen's The Master Builder. Not content with success in only two fields, Mr. Gregory is also a painter and the author of a play in verse, Bone Songs. In This Is Not My Memoir, Gregory takes a vertiginous trip through his memories of the wondrous places and remarkable people that have stirred him most. Tonight, he will be in conversation with co-author Todd London, head of the MFA writing program at the New School, School of Drama. London is also a writer, editor, and contributor to more than 20 other books and winner of a special Tony honor, as well as a Dramatists Guild Award. And I'm not even scratching the surface of his remarkable career in the theater. Andre and Todd, the screen is all yours.
Thank you
so much,
Andy. It's really lovely to hear you introduce us together. Andre and I have been in conversation together for about 17 years. And as we told Andy before the event started, this is our first public event. So we're really—
Of course, we're very nervous.
We are very nervous. We're so nervous. So hello, Philly. Hello, Free Library. We're really happy to be here. And I just want to take a moment to shout out the concerned Black workers and to let you know that we very much stand in solidarity with them.
And ditto, ditto.
We're really glad for all the movement that's happening on their behalf. So that's where we are. I'm going to get us started and turn it over to the maestro. So yes, this is a book that we've been laboring over for now 7 years, and it's a big little book. It's a little book that covers a lot of ground. It's many, many stories from a very storied life of Andre's. It's a book about theater and a little film called My Dinner with Andre. It's a book about spiritual searching. It's a book about failure and more failure and more failure and the things that grow out of failure, the beautiful things. It's a book about finding your vocation and sticking with it. And it's a book about aging and looking at death, and a book about living in and with history. But we want to start with Philly, because so much of Andre's brilliant and vertiginous, I think was the word that Andy used, career begins in Philly. So
hello, Philadelphia.
There you are.
My second city, the city that started me out as a theater director and allowed me to train as a theater director. And this sweater that I wore for rehearsals in Philadelphia, I'm still wearing.
Oh my God, that's shocking. Tell us about Philly and how you came to be there and what your life was there.
Well, Philadelphia was a radically different city at that time. You know, it was the 60s. The middle class had sort of abandoned Philadelphia. Philadelphia was totally ramshackle and run down. There were only two restaurants in Philadelphia, and both of them were lousy. There wasn't a good film cinematheque. although I do remember seeing Dr. No. That shows how old.
Early James Bond. Early James Bond.
And our theater was on South Street, which if you were all Philadelphians out there, you know, in those days was just ramshackle, run down. Our theater was gutted. It was a kind of frightening neighborhood and ugly.
Hmm.
So it was a different city. It was a really different city, but it gave birth to my directing, and I have a very, very fond spot in my heart for it.
How did you happen to wind up there?
Well, I wound up here because I didn't know how to begin directing. And I took Alan Schneider, a very famous director, out to lunch. He directed the premiere of Waiting for Godot, I think in Miami.
Coconut Grove.
And I said, Alan, I want to direct. How do I do that? And Alan said, you start your own theater out of New York. And of course, in those days, there were almost no theaters out of New York. Mm-hmm. And I said, how do I start my own theater? And he said, that's your job. You figure that out. So I got a large map of America, put it on my wall. And I started putting flags in cities. You know, I think there was a red flag for lousy theaters, lousy cities that had a theater, then blue flags in nice cities that had no theater, and a gold flag in a wonderful city that had no theater. And I came to Philadelphia. That was one of my gold cities. And I met an extraordinary man who became my dearest friend in the whole world, Malcolm Eisenberg, who recently passed away. Hello, Malcolm's family, if you're out there. Hi, Zach, my book guru. How are you? And we got the idea of my throwing subscription parties. You know, Malcolm was quite taken with my vision of a theater. God only knows what that was anymore. Mm-hmm. And Malcolm set it up so that I would go to breakfasts, lunches, dinners, cocktail parties with little groups of people. I went to 400 of them.
Wow.
400. I even was almost late for my daughter's birth because I was down in Philadelphia, back to New York, down to Philadelphia. You know, and out of those meetings, we got 8,000 subscribers who had no idea what kind of theater I was going to do. So we had the money to start the theater. We renovated what is now Theater of the Living Arts. That was Philadelphians, my theater originally. Wow. And the rest was history.
Hmm. And okay, so you were there, what, for 3 years? You put on three seasons?
We put on three seasons before the police took me out in a paddy wagon.
Yeah, what's the story? Why?
Well, the board of directors that I had created fired me. And I said, you can't fire me. I created you. And they said, you're fired. We won't pay you. So I said, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter if you don't pay me. I'm going to stay. So they called the cops.
What had you done to be forcibly evicted from your own theater?
Well, what I did, as I'm sure you remember, Todd, is I directed a play called Becklek. And one of my actors brought to me, and it was a weird, dreamlike play about a white, frustrated suburban housewife who goes to a surreal, dreamlike Africa where she feels in this dream do everything she was never able to do with her. Her pathetic husband.
Right.
So she goes to this Africa, she kills animals, she has sexual liaisons with natives. You know, it's a white suburban fantasy. The stage direction is that The landscape is littered with corpses of animals and humans. Oh, and so, of course, you can ask me something.
Well, so we're talking like 1964 experimental surreal theater. This is right?
I guess so.
Okay.
You know, I was a young director, so I was just winging it.
Yeah, yeah.
And having fun.
Okay, it's the 60s.
The 60s, right. Yeah. Okay. So one of the questions was, how do you create a stage filled with corpses of animals and you know, so that there was on our board a guy who was connected to a chemical company or something.
Yeah, like I think that. It was Smith Kline Pharmaceuticals or something.
Something like that.
Right, yeah.
You have a better memory than I do.
Yeah,
they made you're not as old as I am, but you'll be as old as I am.
I will, if I hope to be, yeah.
And this chemist showed up and he said, what would you like, animal smells or human smells? And I said, can you do both? He said, oh, sure. And so about a week later, a little vial of liquid showed up. And remember, it was the 60s and I was young and I was aggressive.
aggressive is one word for it. Yeah, go ahead.
What would you call it?
Well, it's pretty provocative. It's, I mean, right? But keep
going. I was provocative.
Yeah, yeah.
For me in those days, the audience represented my sort of impossible parents. You know, I used to say that my mother and father were like Lady and Lord Macbeth.
Yeah.
I had a strange childhood, very strange. You can read about it in the book.
We'll get to that too. We'll talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when we came to the technical rehearsal, the stage manager said, go with the smell. And we waited and we waited. And then suddenly an actor ran off stage and vomited. The smell was so strong, we had to postpone the opening for a week and clean out the theater.
Oh my God.
And, you know, we would lead the audience down this rather frightening back alley instead of through the front of the theater. And they'd go into this, you know, into backstage. There was a large totem covered with condoms filled with grape juice. And the audience was given a hatchet to break open the condom, and that allowed you to get an African mask, and you went into the theater. You know, the stage wasn't a stage, it was a mud pit with little narrow boardwalks going across it. So anyway, the language was pretty extraordinary,
yeah.
If I may say extraordinary. And I remember there was a moment in the play where the stage direction said that Becklek, her name, the white woman, puts large Chagall-like worms on her pathetic husband's leg, and the leg swells up to enormous proportions. Well, how do you do that? That's where a director comes in. So I solved that problem by upstage having these haystacks that started going up and down like great phalluses, and the Arthur Hall Afro-American Dance Ensemble was doing these wild dances. So you didn't look at the leg. And while you were looking at the penises going up and down and the dancers dancing, they just put a false leg on them. But right. there was a woman, a blue-haired lady, I think in her early 60s, who naturally we didn't take down the alley. You know, that wouldn't have been kind. We took her through the front door.
She was in a wheelchair.
She was in a wheelchair, right. She'd been completely paralyzed for, I think, 12 years. They put her in every kind of therapy imaginable. So she was in a wheelchair. We wheeled the wheelchair down the aisle. We put a book under the wheelchair so, you know, she wouldn't fly. And she was so offended by all this stuff to do with the leg and the penises going up and down that she stepped out of her wheelchair, walked out of the theater. Her son started shouting, "Oh my God, oh my God, mummy's walking, mummy's walking." Everybody in the theater thought it was, you know, a plant, but it wasn't.
And, sure.
Yeah.
And this is your like, hello, Philadelphia.
That's right. Hello, Philadelphia.
I'm a young wild men director with a mainline Philadelphia board of directors.
Right.
And I'm going to just like stick it to you. I mean, I guess the other word that occurred to me, and which is so strange knowing you as I do, and knowing your sort of loving, gentle demeanor as a older man, is it's just so hostile. I mean, it sounds wild, it sounds amazing, but it sounds hostile.
Well, it was both. It was hostile and amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I was learning how to direct in this very flamboyant, wild way. For me, it didn't feel hostile. For me, sure. It felt like a lot of fun. And but you know, yes, it was hostile.
You were,
and I'm no longer hostile.
So there's, I mean, when we get to your later work, like God knows, even the movie, My Dinner with Andre and Uncle Vanya and Master Builder, such a different sensibility. But I want to back up a little. So you've introduced yourself to Philly. You've been taken away in a paddy wagon and dropped in New Jersey. And I can't blame them in some sense. But let's talk a little bit about the history leading up to that. Because one of the things that really, I mean, I've been thinking about this so much lately, and a lot of it in terms of your life, but really for all of us now, it's like there are these moments like today when we live in history and we know we're living in history. We're not unaware of the historical, you know, tides that we're in. And so this moment of pandemic, this moment of political upheaval, this moment of this incredible sort of next stage of the civil rights movement with the Black Lives Matter protests, it's like, how can we escape the fact that we live in history? And you, in a way that's unlike maybe anyone I've ever known, you were born into history. You were kind of one step ahead of it and in it at the same time. Can you just talk a little bit about your childhood journey, like how, where you were born and how you got to the States before you even became?
Well, yeah, I was born into history because I'm so old. I've seen a lot.
But you could have been born in a more boring time.
Oh, yeah, no, I was born as Hitler was taking over Europe. My parents and I were Jewish. We got out of France at the very last moment. We got the last boat train to London. My brother and I were outfitted for gas masks. The London Blitz was about to begin. And when my father got us on a boat to America, there was a sister ship traveling about a mile away. The sister ship was torpedoed. We could see survivors being picked up. We could see people drowning in the water. I mean, this is why, you know, the day that Trump was elected, I was having coffee at a hotel next to our place in New York, and there was this lovely little boy, and he was playing with his hood. He was taking his hood on and off. And I was playing with him, and we got friendly, and the little boy, who I guess was about four, he said, "My daddy says that Trump won't kill me. Is that true?" And of course I said, "Yeah, no, Trump won't kill you." But I saw in that little boy, the Andre, who was a little boy who grew up under fascism, which is part of the reason why Trump terrified me so much on a gut level from the very beginning. But you know, the newspaper was great today. Biden is creating a new cabinet. It's a wonderful cabinet. We could see the end of climate pollution. We hopefully might see the end of racism. And that bastard Trump is crawling off the stage like a mangy old dog with his tail between his legs. My hope is that eventually Trump will share a cell in Alcatraz with Harvey Weinstein, and the two of them can just decay together.
Right. Okay. So I'm gonna cut this, because I remember there was a moment in maybe year five of our work on this book where so much of what we were talking about was that man who you were just mentioning. And I remember thinking, that's wrong. He's
when
like,
you say that man, you mean Beep?
Yeah, I mean that Beep.
Yeah.
And you know, it was like there was this way that you had at that point lived 84 years, and we're writing into your life deeper and deeper. And it became more and more obsessed with Trump and this administration. And so I'm going to just cut it off right here, because I don't want him to take over this, our
either. Absolutely.
And yet I think it was so, one of the things I do want to hear about, because I mean, you started with your own life, but also your father had left Russia when Stalin took over, then he had left Germany when Hitler took over and got to France where you were born. So that sort of trauma, that kind of carrying that sense of what can really go wrong has been with you this whole time, these last
few years. My whole life, yeah.
Yes, your whole life. So you got to the States, and where, just give us a thumbnail of where you land and how one goes from fleeing the Nazis and the Blitz to becoming the Andre Gregory who winds up in Philadelphia, you know, 30 years later. And
well, in order to know that, read the book. But we
ladies
did.
Ladies and gentlemen, yeah.
But, you know, my father went from Moscow to Berlin, from Berlin to Paris, from Paris to London, and from London to Scarsdale. And after...
In Westchester, in New York.
Yeah.
In New York, okay.
And we eventually ended up in Hollywood because my father was in business in Hollywood. And I think that's a very romantic part of the book. Yeah. Our house was filled with the likes of Marlene Dietrich, Greta Garbo, Abbott and Costello, the Marx Brothers, Basil Rathbone, who was Sherlock Holmes, you know, which is probably under the influence of that, the first spark of wanting to work in the theater, even though I was pretty young, came up. So there were the California years, which were beautiful and amazing. And my father just had an amazing ability to bounce back and to make money. And he had a button factory. He was in real estate. He was in perfume. He was very inventive. He was a sick man because he was bipolar. And his being bipolar was, I think, you know, I kept trying to make him feel better as a little boy.
Yeah.
He always, you know, he'd spend the whole winter in bed crying. They had no medication then. And I kept trying to get him to see that the world was a beautiful place. Mm-hmm. And probably that was, for me, the birth of the caretaker. And it was the caretaker in me who I think was always very kind and supportive to mm-hmm. actors.
So that's the director in some way?
That's the director.
Maker of beautiful things to buck your dad up? Is that the artist? Is that the beginning of the artist?
I think that's the beginning of the artist, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. Although,
yeah,
you know, as we talk about in the book, being an artist is a kind of calling. And we don't know where the calling comes from, but it calls us. It calls us, you know.
When was the first time you're aware of hearing the call?
Oh, I think probably when I played the role of Petruchio in The Taming of the Shrew when I was 12 years old. And also, you know, I don't think I've ever told you this, but I wanted to be a writer. I didn't want to be in the theater. And I used to write short stories for the school magazine. And somehow I got derailed and went into the theater for 50 years. But I'm back writing again.
Here we are. Here we are, writing and painting. Well, I think, you know, that it's not surprising, the short stories, because you are such a storyteller, and the form even of the book is kind of like story, story, story that accumulate sometimes in very weird ways. So I'm going to jump a little bit because, you know, we want to leave time for questions at the end. But so out of this rich historical background, your father's depression and despair, you have privilege, so you've met these amazing, inspiring people. You've started to like tell stories and play Shakespearean heroes in boardings or in prep school. And somehow this impulse, you know, takes the shape of, you know, this Philadelphia experience. You have a similar experience in Seattle and another one in LA, 1, 2, 3, where you do these provocative productions that are amazingly theatrical, and you get fired one after another from each one.
Which, believe me, is a very unpleasant experience. Being fired is awful. In retrospect, it makes a funny story, but at the time, it's awful.
At the time, it's terrible. And yet somehow you find the resilience. I mean, one thing, Andre, that I'm remembering is all the times that we were working on this book that you would say, I really want young people to read this book because I think in the stories of my failures and my, you know, getting back on the horse, basically, they might find inspiration.
I hope that would be the case, because I do think we live in very terrifying times, and I can't even imagine what climate change must mean to young people. You know, I'll be gone by the time it really hits, but it's a frightening time. And the big challenge, I think, at a time like this is to find hope. It's not easy. You know, we have a terrible drug problem in America. There's a high suicide rate. God bless you.
Thank you.
People, I think it's a rather hopeless time. And I think any work that can give people light in the darkness is worth it. And I've always felt that, you know, talent doesn't mean that much. Lots of people are talented. What really means something is perseverance, hanging in, not giving up. You know, whether it's in a marriage, you and I have both are married, or a friendship, or a theater production, or just in our lives on this planet. Don't give up.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. So let's go to the end of that period, which is these three successive, you get kicked out of Philly, you get fired in Seattle after a year as associate artistic director at a new Seattle rep, you start up a theater in Watts in LA area, and you get literally punched out by Gregory Peck, all in the book. You start this long-term project, talk about persevering, making a company called the Manhattan Project in a very different vein. So for those of the people listening who don't know, really a seminal work in our theater history is this production of Alice in Wonderland, among other productions that were done by the Manhattan Project. And when I think about your description of the wild Beklek in Philadelphia, or what I know about the other productions, and then I think about Alice in Wonderland, first of all, the amount of time that you took with it, and second of all—
2 years we rehearsed.
2 years, just every day.
Every day, yeah.
Every day with like college students or just out of college, right?
Who became great actors,
yeah. Who became great actors who are still among us, still dazzling us.
Hello, Larry Pine. Hi, Jerry Bammon. Hi, Angela.
And they are, they're with you day after day after day. And there's none of that pyrotechnics. There's no like smells coming through the vents. There's no elephantiasis leg. What are you doing? What's different? How has it changed to make up?
What's different, I think, is that I was learning to trust myself. I didn't have to show off as a director. And under the influence of the Michelangelo of the theater, Jerzy Grotowski, the Polish director, I was fascinated to see what would happen if you had no sets, no costumes, no lights, no music. I wanted an actor who could fly. And we created it. We created magic out of nothing.
Yeah.
Which of course is not unlike what we have to do with our own lives.
It's very much like that. And yet it's such a big shift from the kind of spectacular, provocative spectacle that you were doing before. So there's some huge shift. Was that through meeting Grotowski or was it through growing up in some way?
You know, I'm not sure. I think that my life has been filled with the compulsion to change. You know, I read that nomads in the desert, who are, say, date farmers, they might travel a year to find an uninhabited oasis. They finally find an uninhabited oasis, and they start to farm dates. And there's water on the oasis, they can have children on the oasis, they live on the oasis, they farm on the oasis. Mm. And then, for no reason, 15 or something years later, they leave the oasis.
Yeah.
They go traveling into the desert, looking for an oasis that will probably look exactly the same as the one they left. But they feel compelled to move, to keep moving.
Interesting. And that really seems fitting and descriptive of your long career. We haven't talked about this too much, but I know you know it. In 74, when I went to college, the Manhattan Project came to my small college in Iowa. You weren't there, but they did both Endgame and Alice for us. And my teacher, who I've talked to you about, Sandy Moffat, who I first heard of you from, had spent the previous summer in one of your training programs. So from the time I was 17, your work had somehow entered my life and entered my world very strongly. And I mean, it was so interesting because it was maybe 40 years later that I saw a production of Endgame that you were working on in Provincetown with the same actors. I had seen this aforementioned Larry Pine and Jerry Barry.
But actually, with the exception of your hair and your beard, you still look 17.
Thank you. I still feel 17. So
So do I.
There we have it. So Alice was this amazing, extraordinary thing because you made this whole world from the Mad Hatter's world to the caterpillar to the rabbit hole, everything with just the actors and their bodies and their voices.
Right.
And you went all over the world. I want you to tell about this one point because it's one of my favorite stories, which you describe as one of your favorite performances of Alice, which was in Iran.
Oh.
The Shah's wife.
Oh, yeah. Empress.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, we got invited to the Shiraz Festival by the Empress of Iran. And we were put up in a sort of antiseptic building that was actually a TV studio that was actually a front for Savak, the Iranian secret police. So I said, I'm not doing this. I didn't come all the way to Iran to play in a place like this. So they gave us a car.
It was a TV studio? Just because it was antiseptic and...
But it was also headquarters for their secret police. Okay. It was a front.
Right.
And so my designer, Eugene Lee, and I got in a car. We went all over Shiraz, which is one of the oldest cities in Iran. And we found this exquisite space. It was an onion and garlic packing factory, surrounded by a brick wall with a great tree growing up through the cement. And Eugene, my designer, covered fruit crates with Persian carpets. Mm. And there were kids sitting in the tree, and there were kids sitting on the wall. And when the audience showed up the first time, there was one secret police agent for every three members of the audience. They were given a rectal search. There was a submachine gun put on the wall in front of the actors. There was a submachine gun backstage. The Secret Service were wearing black glasses with attaché cases. You know, it was absolutely terrifying. And the Empress came. She wasn't supposed to come to our performance. She was just supposed to come to the opening night and the closing night of the festival. I guess she heard that Alice was pretty interesting. So she showed up. She sat in the front row. Two interior decorators brought a little Louis XV coffee table for her. And when the performance was over, we were all taken to her palace in the desert. And we sat under a desert moon on a balcony, looking at folk dances that were put on for us, smoking Havana cigars and eating the Queen's white caviar. Wow. It was amazing.
Yeah.
You see, that's the amazing, that's one of the amazing things that I can't really, well, I'll never understand. Why in the world was I given such an amazing life? It's been an amazing life so far, you know, which of course is what it is, what the book is about. It's about the miracle of living. I don't know why it was given to me. I don't know what I did in the last life to deserve it, but here I am.
It's really wonderful. It's a gift. And it also goes back to this thing you were talking about in terms of hope and small actions that have big impact. Do you know, there you are in a room with NYU students working for 2 years on God knows what, you know, to God knows what end. You'd lost three jobs and a Broadway show at that point. And you make this.
You should add that the Broadway show was a comedy about bestiality.
Yes.
Made Broadway history by closing the night before it was supposed to open.
Yeah, talk about making history as you go. But this small thing, what a small thing Alice really was in the scope of things. And yet you toured it for how many years? You went to Iran, you went everywhere.
All over the world, yeah, yeah.
And there was this kid in Iowa, in a college, who saw it, who, however many years later, was asked to write about you at age 70. And here we are 17 years after that, and we have this book together. It's like these small but resonant connections.
You bring up something interesting, because often when one is beginning in life, you're filled with uncertainty. You don't know where you're going. You're terrified of making mistakes. You might have a marriage that fails. You might get fired from work. But I always say, as an older man looking back on a long life, every single thing that you experience leads to something else that can be quite wonderful.
Yeah.
The awful things lead to something very fruitful. Don't despair. Don't give up.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to turn to questions in a minute. And I know that one of our first questions is going to be about my dinner with Andre. So I'm sure people are really excited to hear about that. And maybe Uncle Vanya and Vanya on 42nd Street as well. But I want to talk about this period, because after Manhattan Project breaks up and your life is kind of in the shitter, you're really distraught. You think you're leaving the theater, you leave for something like 12 years, and you really go into this period of searching. You know, this theme that keeps coming up in our conversation, and I think in your life and in our work together, which is like, what happens when you've finished with a phase of your life? What happens when you bottom out on something? How do you persevere? What's next? How do you figure out what's next? What is the search? And so much of what interests me about your journey and what interests me about my dinner with Andre, which we'll get to through the questions, is the kind of wilderness period that you went literally into the desert, right, and literally in search of wisdom and next phases and so on. And I'd like to ask you to read a little bit from one of my favorite parts of the book. Do you have the book with you?
I do. I always have it with me. Have it in the bathtub.
You sleep it with it too? Yeah. Yeah. On page 111, can you read about, maybe just set this up briefly, and then read about the journey to Ladakh. Can you just set this up a little? And maybe start at after 3 or 4 days of your harrowing journey.
Ladakh, trying to find 111. Okay, here it is. Ladakh was, I was working with Tibetan refugees and in Dharamsala, which was the center for the Dalai Lama in exile. And after I worked with the refugees, the Tibetan monks asked me if I would like, what would I like anything? And I said, yes, I'd like to go to Tibet. And they said, no, you can't go to Tibet. Tibet's occupied by the Red Chinese. So they took me to Ladakh, which was on the border of China, Russia, Bhutan, Tibet. It had been closed off by the Indian army for 40 years. So I was the first Westerner to ever go into Ladakh. It had been closed off because it was such a hot spot militarily. And so I showed up in this wild, wild terrain at the top of the world. I think it was 9,000 feet high, all on my own, thinking, what in the world have I done? Why have I come here?
Yeah.
I'm a married man, I have children, I shouldn't be doing this. So what happens on page 111?
Well, let's start then a little bit later, because we want to get to the things you described, this hermitage that you'd come to.
Oh, yeah.
Start on page 112. From there, two pilgrims drove me to the monastery.
Drove me to the monastery. Oh, yeah. Let me point out here that I was not at that point in my life a spiritual man. I had no interest in spiritual books. I considered myself an agnostic. I was like Saul of Tarsus, a businessman on his way to Damascus when he saw Christ. Saul's life was changed forever. He became Paul. The businessman became the apostle. I know that what I'm about to say will to some seem far-fetched and unbelievable, just as I find it far-fetched that an image shot thousands of miles away can appear instantly on my television, that I can talk into a glass tablet and letters will appear on the face of the tablet. My story would not seem unbelievable to Teresa of Avila, though. Some believe in the miraculous and others simply don't. Some stay rooted, feet on the ground, and some adventure and pursue the invisible. In my dinner with Andre, there is an Andre who believes and a Wally who never will. The film needs both to exist. Probably we all do. Anyway, I finally looked up to see the Rinpoche. There, sitting on a small raised throne, remember, this was in the middle of nowhere, was a paunchy elderly man with a long, long beard. I looked into his eyes. What I saw there seemed not so much eyes as planets. These planets were all light. I began to weep, and he began to laugh. The laughter I heard sounded like magnificent bells. I began to roar with laughter. He laughed more at my laughter, and I began to weep again. I laughed and wept and wept and laughed. He spoke in a language I couldn't understand. And at the end of whatever he was saying, he took me by the hand and led me to the window. He pointed at the desert landscape. It was early afternoon, but the sky suddenly went black. Comets were streaking across the sky. As we drove out of the monastery, I was overcome by a love more powerful than anything I had ever experienced. I adored him. I loved him. All I wanted to do was stay with him.
Oh, thank you.
There's a lot more like that in the book. Yeah.
And I love, I wanted you to read the pages before because I love the description, going up into the mountains and seeing the monastery and the monks taking each other's place when they fall asleep. I mean, it is an amazing story in a life of amazing stories. So here's a real straightforward one, Andre. This is from Dustin Wilson.
Hi, Dustin.
What is the root of your friendship with Wallace Shawn, and how did the My Dinner with Andre project come about?
Oh, I directed Wally's first play in New York. That's another long story that's in the book. But we knew each other quite well. I had had years of not knowing what the hell I was doing. Wally called me up one day and he said, you know, when I'm your age, I don't want to be like you. What about the two of us getting together? You could tell me the stories of what you've been doing, being buried alive, you know, all that stuff, so I can learn what I shouldn't do when I'm your age. And so we sat down, I think for 2 years, every day would begin with a story about anything. And we would talk and talk and talk. And out of that came, I think, a 2000 page manuscript that Wally finally fine tuned and edited and recreated into the script that was My Dinner with Andre. I have to say, though, you know, now that the movie has become a kind of legend, that people think it was always successful, but it wasn't. When we opened the movie, we opened it up to universally bad reviews. Time magazine said it looked like an amateurish project by people who weren't professional, without a director and no script. The New York Times said, it's a sort of Winnie the Pooh kind of fable, if you like that sort of thing. I don't. The reviews were terrible. They were really terrible. But we were saved at the very last second. We had opened in four theaters. Siskel and Ebert, if you remember them, the wonderful critics, they dedicated a half hour to the film, and then they dedicated another half hour and named My Dinner with Andre and Reds as the best film of the year. And suddenly 200 theaters across the country wanted My Dinner with Andre. It was miraculous. It was unbelievable.
It was miraculous. And you're a lucky man. You know, you're a really, not to take away from talent or anything, but you are, what a stroke of luck to have them love it so much and have the platform.
Oh yeah, if we hadn't met them at the Telluride Festival and if they hadn't seen the film there, we would have occasionally appeared in a Louis Malle retrospective as one of his lesser films. Yeah. Luck is a big thing. You know, it's like, as you know, one of the biggest things in my life, and this is in the book, is my love for my wife, Cindy. Meeting her was a stroke of divine luck. But then you've got to have eyes to see. You've got to know that this is something incredibly precious. Don't let it go. So it's a combination of luck. Well, you know, when I was at college, I was passionate about playing poker. And I learned that the art of winning at poker is not playing with a great hand like four aces or a royal flush. The art of winning at poker is to win with a mediocre hand. So, you know, sometimes you just get given a strange situation. Somebody at the Rockefeller Foundation says, would you like to come to Ladakh and teach Tibetan refugees? And you could say no, or you could say yes. It's the saying yes to life. Yeah. Yes, I think that woman is dreaming. Yes, I think that's a project I want to do. Yes, I want to write a book even though I've never done it before. Yes, I will find Todd London. You know, you have to say yes to life.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so this is Judy Matthews.
Hi, Judy.
She thanks you. I'm gonna give you the question last, though she starts with it. She thanks you for helping them in San Francisco decades ago when they were doing a benefit for Jacek, and you came to a benefit screening of My Dinner with Andre. It was a pleasure to meet you and spend time with you at that time. All best, Judy Matthews. And she asks if you would comment on the legacy of Jerzy Gratowski.
Oh, I can't. I really can't. You know, as I said, he was the Michelangelo of theater. And his legacy is whatever each of us wants to find in his work or his writing or his life. The seed, the little seed that we take from his work and his life, and what it is we make out of that. You know, it's like one could ask, what is the legacy of Cézanne? But Cézanne's influence gave rise to extraordinary painters that he influenced. So the legacy, I think, is in the younger people who take something from the old men and women like me and make something out of it.
Mm, thank you. You know, now that you're talking about him, I realize that I think if there is something that I have been jealous of you all these years, it's having found in him, it's not him in particular, but having found in him that combination of teacher and brother for a life, do you know? That the intensity, and I hope it does come across in the book, the intensity of your relationship with him, the mutual love, his love for Chiquita, your first wife, hers for him, you know, I guess I'm going to interrupt the questions and ask for you just to say a word about the end of his life. And because Chiquita was also ill at the time too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just because I mean, yes, it's a theatrical influence. Yes, you sort of sat at each other's feet and by each other's sides. But the depth of that friendship is something that I find really extraordinary.
Well, the depth of that friendship does bring up, I think, one of the big themes of the book, which is love, the necessity for love, the love that we have for a friend, the love we have for a teacher, the love we have for what we do, the love we have for the world. So, you know, he was somebody who gave birth to love in me, and that's important.
Mm. Yeah, I do think that's a great sort of theme of the book. It's like, how do you learn to love when you haven't been shown love as a child?
Right. Yeah.
And when, you know, and how do you sort of unbury the love that you carry inside you?
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's something that we've both struggled with in our own ways. And I do hope it comes through.
Okay, yeah, when you talk about that, I just started what looks like a lovely book. I hope I get the title right. If You See Him, Let Me Know.
Oh, is that a novel that I wrote?
Yeah, Todd London's new book. It looks lovely. Go out and read it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I really appreciate that. It means a lot to me. Okay, here is a statement from Ed Hoffman. This is recalling your Philadelphia time. I remember being in 12th grade at Central High in 1964, and our English teacher told us about this new theater, Living Arts, and the availability of half-price tickets for students. I remember Tiger at the Gates in the first season, Room Service later. Among the great actors were Harris Yulin, Gloria Maddox, and Ronald Rostin. Everybody talks about Beklek. Nobody talks about Room Service.
Oh, and they should. They should. Yeah.
That's really lovely. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Here's a question from, I guess he's gone. He was somebody who, here he is, from Sean Bervin, who he's a student at the New School where I teach. He's a first year director at the BFA program. He says, Andre, you shared advice you were given as a young director, but I would like to know what advice you have for young directors.
Oh, what a great question. Well, Stanislavski, when he had his school for actors and directors, would not let anyone direct anything in the first year. They had to read great novels. They had to travel on the trolley car and look at human beings and watch how they walk and how they, they had to listen to music. So I think culture, to be cultivated, especially in this time, is very, very important. So fill yourself with culture and then find your own way. There is no way to teach directing. Just do it. Make your own theater. All of us, many of us, including me, I can do 60 push-ups. Go to the gym two or three times a week. If you can go to the gym two or three times a week, you can rehearse two or three times a week. Find some people with whom you feel totally at home and just begin to work and work and work and work and work. Mm-hmm. Hang in there. Don't give up.
All right. And then Laura Kovacs, on the same sort of the same subject, do you have any advice for fellow actors and artists frightened about their livelihood right now?
Oh, that's awful. It's awful. No, I don't know how to answer that. Just so many people are in terrible straits now, and it may get worse. I would just say be patient, be persevering, hang in there. These times will change. And there will be a theater again waiting for you. So you wait for it.
All right. And then we have just a few more, and they're quickies. And then I'm going to throw something else at you. Tony Tanner wants to know if there's a video of Alice out there in the gloaming.
No, sadly not. You can watch an amazing film that my wife Cindy made, called Andre Gregory Before and After Dinner. And it does have in it some amazing clips, amongst the only ones that there are of Alice. And then, if you can afford $2,000 for a paperback, there is Richard Avedon's amazing book that he made of Alice in Wonderland. You might be able to find it, somehow. Yeah. That has hundreds and hundreds of pictures of Alice, and it's extraordinary.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah. It's a beautiful book, and it's interviews with the actors on how we created Alice. If you can find it, it's great.
I think you can find it used. You can find it with broken binding and all of that, but the mm-hmm. pictures, which are full page, it's an extraordinary book. Mine has completely fallen apart. I bought
so
it.
So is mine.
And maybe we should think about packaging This Is Not My Memoir and Cindy's movie together. And sending it. Then there's two more, and they're totally related. And then I want to end with one other thing. Did you enjoy, Susan T. Case, did you enjoy the mention of my dinner with Andre action figures and waiting for Guffman?
Oh, it was great. I had a lady friend at the time, and we were doing that terrible dance that people can do together. You know, I'd approach her and she'd run away. I'd run away and she'd approach me. And we'd had a disagreement that day. We went to the movie. We were both in a terrible mood. I knew nothing about the action figures. And suddenly, as we were walking out of the movie in the credits, there they were, and made our day. We were much nicer to each other.
Wow. And then just—
But Wally got the action figures, which breaks my heart, yeah.
Oh, that doesn't seem fair.
Well, you know, nothing's fair.
No, I guess that's true. Well, here's the other piece of it. Benjamin McVoy, what did you think of the My Dinner with Andre video game on The Simpsons?
I never saw it.
Oh, YouTube it. I think it's on YouTube.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, tonight. Here's the last thing. I've been really enjoying another book by a late friend of yours, Howard Zinn. And I've been thinking about it in our conversations about hope and even what you've brought up tonight. And he says, in the conclusion of his autobiography, which is called You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. He says, to be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. We don't have to engage in grand heroic actions to participate in the process of change. Small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, can transform the world. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think, Howard was a neighbor on the Cape and a friend. And he would say that nothing of value has ever been done in Washington. Everything of value has been done in the streets. There would have never been an end to the Vietnam War if it hadn't been for action in the streets. There would never have been integration of the schools if there hadn't been action in the streets. And we're seeing what Black Lives Matter could do. So yeah, I think it's getting off your butt, going out into the street and taking a small action which can change the world.
And as an artist?
Well, Howard Zinn himself, Cindy and I were so horrified when Bush was elected for the second time that we went over to Howard's and we said, we don't know what to do. We're in despair. What do we do, Howard? And Howard said, well, you know, you should do the usual thing. You can protest, you can march, you can call your congressman. That's all important. But he said, most of all, and this was very surprising coming from a man who had walked with Martin Luther King, who had, you know, walked his talk. He said, more than anything, make your art. In times of darkness, art brings life and light.
Let's just end with that, Andre.
Sounds good. Thank you, Philadelphia.
Thank you, Library.
Thank you, Todd. Andy.
Thanks, Andre. Talk to you later.
And thank you for all the years of your work.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.